like to share about my life. Let's begin with my parents. So my parents are Willis Carrico, who was born in St. Louis, Missouri in 1920. And my mother is Doris Eileen Reiner, who was born in Omaha, Nebraska. And they met in San Diego, California. They were both in the Navy. My father would come into port into San Diego now and then, and my mother was in a Christian kind of a Bible study. So this handsome man was always coming every few months, and all the ladies were really excited that he's coming, and that happened to be my dad. But my mother was so shy that she never even hardly approached him. But my father sought her out, and 2 months after they met, my parents married. And that was a month before the end of World War II. So 1945, July, they married. And in the next year, 1946, my sister was born. And my father had decided that he wanted to go to Bible school, so he went to La Mirada, California, BIOLA, Bible Institute of Los Angeles, and that's where he studied for a couple of years. And so my sister was born, then my brother was born, and then I was born. So 1946, 48, and 1950 I was born. And my father finished Bible school and set off with our family to Japan to become missionaries. And it was an amazing time because there were no the airplanes were not in use at that time. I mean, people didn't fly at that time, so everyone had to go on boats. So my parents went on a freighter, and it took a month to get to Japan. They went to Yokohama. And so my father began studying in Karuizawa in Nagano Prefecture. There were other missionaries gathered there studying, and I think there was a compound there, kind of like the way we live sometimes. And so all the missionaries and their wives and their children, we got to know each other that first year. So my father studied Japanese, and just after 1 year, he went into the countryside into a place called Shimagawara, which even the Japanese don't even know. It's a very small place, but his language teacher happened to come from that village, so that was the village he chose. So we moved into a Japanese farmhouse, which is very different than here. It was a cold place. There was no central heating. The only heating was something under the ground where you put your feet and then you pull a blanket over you. And maybe they had some kind of a charcoal heater in another area of the house, I'm not sure. But there was no kitchen, so my father had to build a kitchen for my mother. It was a dirt floor. Outside was a well, a pump, which was shared by three families. And remember, this is just after World War II. So the countryside, even though they had houses, they were very, very poor. So I think the person who had the most difficulty must have been my mother, because it was completely, she didn't speak Japanese at all. We always, as time went on, we were always the people who translated for her. Somebody came to the door, and my mother wasn't able to understand. We children would go and tell her what they're saying. So my father loved being a missionary, totally loved it. He would adapt everything. He'd, like, have a bicycle with kind of a cart on the side. He'd put us children in the cart, and he'd take us with him somewhere. And we children loved it, too. We got to know the neighborhood children. They were just our friends, you know. So we learned Japanese just like they did. So when I was 5 years old, we went back to America for 1 year because missionaries do that. Every 5 years, they go back to their country. So I was in kindergarten. I remember speaking to someone at that time and then laughing at me. And it was because I spoke in Japanese. And I didn't know that was Japanese. But my mother told me after that, I didn't speak any Japanese the whole year because I had been so shocked by them laughing at me. So anyway, after that year we went back to Japan, we settled in Tokyo because we needed to go to school. And so we needed to go to an American school. There was a missionary school there, and it was called Japan Christian Academy in Japan. So we children went from first grade to 12th grade in that school. And it was a school that was not that far away. It took about an hour one way, which was not that bad. We walked a mile to the train station, got on the train, and changed trains again, and then a mile again or so from that train station to our school. So we did this year after year, and we grew up together, all these kids whose parents were missionaries mostly. So to this day, we still have reunions. We had a 10-year reunion, 20-year, 30-year, 40-year. Last year I went to San Diego and joined some of our, my friends. And next year we're going to have a 50th high school reunion. I don't even feel 50, but 50 years since we graduated from high school. And we're just laughing at each other when we say that because most of my friends have grandchildren, and some of them have great-grandchildren. And so we're looking at each other and we're going, what happened? We still feel like we're 18. You know, you're the same, Mary. You know. So anyway, these people are very precious to me. And so because I grew up that way, I feel often like a second gen myself because I grew up in this very strict community. And then I was put out in the world. You know, I left when I was 18. 17, we came back to America. And by 18, my parents had moved away, so I was on my own. And so I worked a little bit, didn't go to college yet, but I got a job offer in Portland, Oregon. And it was at the Japanese consulate. So while I was there for the 3 years that I was there, I made friends with a lot of people. To make this long story short, I decided I'm going to travel to many countries. And so I bought a ticket from Portland, Oregon to Calcutta, India. And I set off on my traveling. So the first 8 months I spent in Japan, I traveled from north to south to east to west and in the villages. And it was the most amazing time. Because I speak Japanese, I had no problem. But then after that, and the memories are so many, but this isn't really where I can talk too much about individual experiences so much. But I have them in my heart, and often I'm just remembering, wow, I did that? That was my experience? Anyway, I went to Korea during the time I was in Japan. One thing I do remember when I went to Korea was I went into the villages in Korea, and I was going, oh my gosh, that's just like the village that we grew up in. Because actually at that time, Korea was not quite as advanced as Japan in the 70s. And so I was like so excited to experience that kind of wholesome way of living again. And then I went to many countries. I went to Taiwan, to Hong Kong, to the Philippines. I stayed there 6 weeks and had beautiful experiences and learned to really love the Filipino people at that time. And then I continued to Thailand and to Burma. And I just want to tell one story when I went to India, to Calcutta, and this was kind of a turning point for me. That's why I want to tell this story. I had traveled a lot. I had already been traveling for about a year and had spent a lot of time in people's homes and gotten to know people in different cultures, and it was just so deep for me, my experiences. So I knew what poor people were, but when I came into Calcutta on the plane and then on the bus in through the city of Calcutta, I could not believe that this was really real. Because even at the airport, there were some young people whose arms and legs were cut off, and they were begging. And then as we went through the streets of Calcutta, I looked left and right, and I was just, oh my gosh, this is really real. And I was extremely disturbed. And so two friends that I had made I had made friends basically on the airplane, and they said, why don't you stay where we're going to stay? So that was actually an amazing bed and breakfast. It was actually the home of Rabindranath Tagore, one of his family homes. And the lady who was the owner, actually, of it was a lady of the Baha'i faith, and Mrs. Singh. And she said, sure, yeah, you can stay here. So I stayed, and that first night, I couldn't sleep all night long. I was watching the geckos, you know, racing on the ceiling and the fan going around and crying all night long. I was crying out to God. I said, I can't believe it, that this is what hell on earth is. Oh, my, you know, and I was just praying and praying. And so in the morning when Mrs. Singh saw me and we talked, she saw that I hadn't slept and everything. She says, well, why did you come with me today? I'm going to go through the nearby village and do my charity work. You want to go with me? And I said, oh, sure. So we got in the rickshaw and went down to this, actually it was a slum, because the people in that place, they were like families of 7, 8, 9, 10, but they all lived in one room. They only had one room. And she would speak to them in such a passionate, compassionate way. And I was so impressed by her. They loved her. And she was trying to teach them about birth control or something like that. But anyway, she was a very wonderful woman. And then we got in the rickshaw again and started going, kind of going back home, I think. And we came close to this one area where there were a long line of people with tin bowls. And so I was looking, and she was pointing them out. She says, see that long line of people there? And then she said, look at the, as we got closer, she said, do you see that big, huge vat, like a big bowl? Not a bowl, a pot. And then we came closer, and I did. And she said, see, do you see that little woman there? And I, of course I did. And she said, that's Mother Teresa. Do you want to meet her?
Wow.
And I said, yes. And so we got off of the rickshaw and went over there. And she knew her very well. And so she introduced me to Mother Teresa. And Mother Teresa just basically, she said, oh, go up to the children. And so I went to where the children were up there. And I can never forget that first experience where I was embraced by, is more like it, a little snotty boy with snot. And I held him, and I still remember the warmth that I felt when he said, Mama, or something like that. And then I was also guided to the home for the dying, which was on the same compound. That was where people were picked up off the streets, and they could die in dignity, or sometimes they didn't even die. They just got better and then went on to live. But some of the people that were there, it was just amazing to think that's somebody's mother or father, and that's the compassion that Mother Teresa had, and she had that, she shared that with other people. And so there were a lot of people helping people. That was 1973. And so I was so deeply moved by that. I did stay there for a few days with Mrs. Singh, and I helped out kind of like served Mother Teresa. I was never able to meet her personally again, but I did see her in the compound, and it was like so beautiful to experience. So after that, I took the train with these same friends that I had. They were going up to Nepal, so I said, oh, great, I'll go with you. So we went to Kathmandu on third-class train. If you know what third-class train is, it's like the people bringing their own food and their dogs and their chickens and everything together with them. And so we went all the way up to Kathmandu that way, or at least to Nepal, and then we had to transfer to a bus and then to go to Kathmandu. So Kathmandu is the main city in Nepal. I was there for about a week or so, and then decided to, we had to get a permit to trek in the, you know, trekking is like walking, but there's no bicycles, there's no, of course, no cars, no bicycles. Everybody walks because the mountains are so extreme there. And so I was able to go for a week trekking from house to house. So we would go to a mountain family, and they would allow us to sleep in their, like a, maybe like something like an attic, and then they would, we would have the dal, the soup. That's the same thing that we had every place. And it was very an amazing experience to be in those homes and to feel the heart of people that live that way. I just can't express the depth of heart that I felt during that time. Of course, there was no electricity, no toilets. So the rivers or the streams were where we washed ourselves. The toilets were wherever. And it was a wonderful experience that I had. And then even after that, I traveled. I continued to travel through, back to Thailand, and then through Malaysia and Singapore and Indonesia. And the place that I stayed 2 months was in Bali, Indonesia. It was an amazing experience. I stayed with the singers. Not the singers, the dancers, the Balinese dancers. You know, you've seen them with their body twisting, and that was beautiful to stay in the village together with those kind of people. I could still remember the sky in Bali. It was there was no electricity, remember, even there, but it was lit up, and it was like so close. The stars were like right there; you could almost touch them. It felt so different, and I still feel that place in Bali that I stayed at. I can just close my eyes and I'm there. So that was something I did in 1973, 4, and 5. And finally I came back to America, and I was trying to decide, what am I going to do with my life, you know? And so I said, I'm definitely not going to stay in America, because the Americans had no idea about that kind of life, that kind of heart. And I was so disappointed. I went into McDonald's to eat, and all these things they were throwing out, and my heart was just like aching, like, oh my gosh, people in Calcutta, they could use this for like a month or so. My heart was just aching when I came back to America. So I knew that I had to go back to the world. So the best way to do that was to become a teacher again, English teacher. So then I got a visa to go to Japan. And so I got a visa. Did I talk about the way we grew up in Japan? I think I didn't even talk about that. Anyway, there's so much in my life that it's so hard to know what to talk about, but anyway, I'll skip it for now because I don't know where to start. So let's say now we're, oh my goodness, I'm going to almost join the church now, and I skipped a lot of my life. So anyway, I went back to Japan and started teaching English, and ended up in an island called Shikoku, which is one of the four main islands in Japan. And I was teaching English, and suddenly, one day, all these Western people were there in front of the train station. And I was told by the Catholic people that were announcing things that don't talk to those people. They're not good, you know. And so that was my first taste of Unification Church members. They were the global team. They were wonderful people that came from many different countries. And it was right after the Yoido rally in 1975. They came and were witnessing Western people from Europe and America. And then also the New Hope singers were there, and the dancers, the Hansam Byodan. So they all came to my city where I was the teacher. And they came to my place, and so I was trying to avoid them, taking my bicycle, going around the back side of the train station or the other side. But every time I went, trying to not talk to them, I would find one person, and they would stop me and talk to me. But I, even though I said, okay, I'll go, I didn't go. But the third person who actually got me was, I was going up to the place that I taught English at my ABC school. And as I came down, this one lady, Linda, she got me, and she said, let's have coffee. So I did. I think she was watching me the whole time I was teaching. I'm not sure, but I think she calculated exactly when I'm going to come down. So then that person I listened to, and so she invited me to go where they were staying. They were staying in a bowling alley. And the reason they were staying in a bowling alley is at that time in Japan, they had bowling alleys that didn't do well. They were no longer using them. So they were empty. So it was perfect for our members because they could stay with their sleeping bags, and they could also give lectures there, and they could eat there, and they could do everything in these big bowling alleys. So I took my bicycle and I went up to way up the top of the hill, and multiple times I went there. And they prepared these English lectures for me. And then after a week or two, they said they were going to leave, and they were going to Nagoya, which is on the main island of Japan. And so I said, okay, and I said goodbye to them, but they kept calling me, and they said, are you studying, and have you, can you come to Nagoya? And I said, no, I can't come. I'm their only teacher there. There's no way I can leave. And they kept saying, no, you can go. You can do it. So finally, I did. I went. I went to Nagoya and told my school that I couldn't teach them for a little while, and it was really hard getting a substitute, but I did. So I went to Nagoya, and they had prepared a 7-day workshop for me in English, so just for me. So I went there, and I went through the 7-day, and I was going to go back. And they said, oh, well, you know, why don't you call and tell them that you need to go to this other place, the 3-day workshop at Moriyama workshop place. And so that was really hard, but I did. And I called up and I said, I can't come. I mean, they were really mad at me. But then it was a Japanese workshop. And the lecturer kept saying to me, Mary-san, wakarimasu? Do you understand? Do you understand? And I was writing down the words that I didn't know in Romaji, in Roman letters. But then suddenly I put my pen down and I was listening so carefully, because that was when they were talking about Jesus and about the life of Jesus. And the lecturer could see very clearly that I understood, because my tears were streaming down my face and I was going like this. So I think that was about the time that I decided, I guess I got to join this church, because I had struggled so much. I was praying all night long, just like in Calcutta, saying, God, I don't want to do it, but it seems like I need to do this, right? And then I would get inspired again. And anyway, I did it, like so many other people have done. You know, they've joined in unusual ways. So that team of people, of what would I say? That global team, they call it. Okay, that global team went to Tokyo. So then I witnessed with them as a new member for a couple of months. And then they said they're going to America. So I joined them. By the end of 1975, I was in Barrytown, New York, listening to Reverend Sudo's lectures. And it was an 120-day workshop at that time. And Leslie was there then, and she was the nurse. I do remember that. And then I was asked to go to Rhode Island and some other places, pioneering with different people. And I went to the Yankee Stadium campaign, to Yankee Stadium. Yes, we took buses there. And then next was the Washington Monument campaign. And by that time, I was at 43rd Street in New York. And I took one bus, and I was the bus captain. And so when we, it was a wonderful time. That was the first time I actually heard, True Father speak. And then it was like so exciting. Actually, maybe it wasn't the first time I heard him speak, but in that kind of situation. And so it was very amazing. Yeah, yeah. And then at the end, there was a celebration at the end of the Washington Monument campaign. Everybody gathered it at 43rd Street. And Mr. Kamiyama was there. And he was aware that I spoke Japanese, so he grabbed me and he said, "Oh, come with me and come to my house and stay with my wife, and then you can translate for my wife. She needs to go to the MFT teams." And so then I joined her. I mean, I went to their house and basically stayed a lot of years with them here and there, and went with Mrs. Kamiyama to the different MFTs where she spoke. And I still remember, and other people still remember me to this day, that I went to their MFT team, you know, together with Mrs. Kamiyama. But one situation that one sister said, "Oh, I thought Mrs. Kamiyama was speaking in English." But that was the best compliment to me, because that means that she remembered Mrs. Kamiyama there, and I was there, but she didn't remember me, which means that that somehow God was able to use me, even though it wasn't easy to translate. She thought she was listening, you know. Anyway, from Mrs. Kamiyama. That was in my heart for many years. When I heard that, I thought, wow, that's how God uses us. And anyway, so many things happened. I went to a couple different... I went to MFT a little bit, a few months. And then I went to Dan Pfefferman's IOWC team somewhere. What was that, Kentucky or something? And then I joined another MFT team. And it was Mother's Day 1979. And suddenly I was called with my friend Cynthia, who was on the same team, to stop fundraising and get in the van. And we said, wait a minute, this is the best time. What are you talking about? You know, I can't quit now. I haven't made my goal yet. But he said, "No, you're going to New York." "New York? Come on in. So he told us we're going to the matching in New York. So we went to New York, both Cynthia and I, and we went to to the New Yorker Hotel. And our true parents were matching people. That's how it happened. So we went there, and both of us. So I was number 24 in 705 couples. 705 couples. So Father matched this wonderful sister who had like 100 spiritual children, and he was talking to Vera from Netherlands. And... yeah, you know. And so she stood up, and then Father matched her with this wonderful Japanese brother, mm-hmm. Ichinori. And so then they left, and then right next to him was my husband-to-be, Mamoru. And so Father had already looked at me. When people like Father looks at you, you know he looked at you. So I knew he looked at me already. But then... when he went like this, he didn't look at me, but he pointed to my husband and then went like this. So I was like, "Oh, okay, I'm supposed to stand up," and people were helping me stand up. "Yes, you're supposed to stand up." And then that person over there, he's coming. So I just started walking, but he was way over there, and the people were laughing. I must have been cute. I don't know. Good. And then I said, "Oh, I'm supposed to wait for him to come." Okay. And then right in front of us was True Mother right there and Mrs. Phyllis Kim. And Mother was smiling, and then Mrs. Kim there. And as we walked by, she said to my husband, Mamoru, beautiful. So that's so we went upstairs and we talked for a little while, very short time. We agreed this is good, you know, we'll do it. Yes, yes, we will. So then we came down and we signed a paper, and it was number 24. That's why I remember we were number 24. And so my husband and I, we weren't a husband and wife then, but oh, you want to go out to the diner and have coffee? Okay. Let's go. So we went out to the... My father's still matching people back here. We talked for 1-2 hours, and he discovered that I spoke Japanese, and he thought that was cool, but it wasn't that important to him. So it was great. We found out we knew each other. Because, anyway, he had been at East Garden, just to tell you about my husband-to-be. In 1974, he became a security at East Garden. He was like 20, I think. And then I was also at the Kamiyama's house at that time. So many times father would come to feed the geese. There was a pond at this place called White House. It wasn't White House, but it was like a house that Mr. Kamiyama, you'll learn about him later, he lived. And he remembered that I gave him bread one time for the geese. And Yoshiko, the daughter of Mr. Kamiyama, was laughing at him because he was speaking to me in English. And she said, Ajashi, Uncle, you don't have to speak to her in English. She speaks Japanese. And she was like just four or five years old at that time. So he remembered that. And then he remembered that that's who I am. Oh, yeah. So, and we have another memory, but I don't know how much time we have, so I'm not going to go too much into depth. But that was the person I was matched to in 1979. Then we had a 3-year engagement. So two weeks after that, I went to Japan, and he stayed in America. So the reason I went to Japan is Mr. Furuta, who was in charge of all the in Japan, he was in charge of practically everything that had to do with fundraising and selling and business. But he didn't speak English. And so True Father said, oh, he needs an English teacher. And then Mr. Kamiyama said, oh, I know an English teacher. I know someone who could be an English teacher. And so Mr. Kamiyama recommended me, and I went to Japan to teach Mr. Furuta English. But when I did go to Japan, he didn't want to study English because he's one of those people that, very, very smart person, but linguistics was at the bottom of his smartness. He just didn't want to take time for English. So he was always trying to find a way for me to do something else. And when I was come up, oh no, the devil has come. Oni ga kita. So then it was funny because then Mrs. Furuta, his wife, said, well, you know, I think you can teach at the preschool. You can teach the children at the preschool. So then they set up an English program for me to teach at the preschool. It was that preschool. Now those children who were in that preschool are leaders in our church right now in Japan and in America, and they still remember me. They're probably like 40 or something like that. They're really, yeah, around that age. And also Mr. Kuboki, who was the president of the Japanese church, said, well, if you don't want her, I'll take her. So then I became Mr. Kuboki's secretary, kind of, and I traveled around with him to Taiwan and Korea and different places and had amazing experiences. Mm-hmm. In 1982, I came back to the blessing. We were blessed with 2,075 couples. So that was why I came back to America. And it was funny that 2,075 blessing, there are a lot of couples, but my husband and other security from East Garden were the last people. So everybody went through, and then there's all these ladies standing together with no husband to be. What are you guys doing there? Why are you just standing there? Well, we're waiting for our husbands to come. But they were security, so they had to come at the last minute. Just everybody's going in, going in, going in, and the curtain's closing. So the last people are security. They had to run and catch up with their wives-to-be. So then we were the last ones. We were the last ones to go in. So and then that's quite an interesting memory, you know. Always alone. And even in that evening, they had entertainment, and two parents were here sitting, and so everybody's sitting with their new husband. I was not sitting with my new husband because he was actually, it's very beautiful because he was sitting with mother. He was right behind, protecting true mother. So there was nothing to be sad about, but I do remember being sad that time. So that was kind of my life. That was a taste of what my life is going to be. And so, anyway, I did many things. And then in 1985, that was just 3 years after our blessing, I went to start my family with my husband. That's the way we started our family was he had a room, and then we did our 3-day ceremony, and then he always had that room. And that was in the Kamiyama's house, that same family that I had been working with before. They loved him, and they loved me, and they just became, you know, they took care of us. So, but the thing is, I was not actually living there yet. I was in Maryland, so we started our family, but I had to go back to my mission in Maryland, which was like a city leader. And so every month I would go visit my husband at the right time of the month in the car, go to see him, and come back. Oh, again, for almost a year, I did that. I went to see my husband. It was nice, you know, it was like having a 3-day fling, whatever. And then one time I went there, I arrived, and he wasn't there. And Mrs. Kamiyama said, oh, he went to the science conference over there across in New Jersey. You have to go. It's like 2 or 3 hours away. I have an idea, she said. Why don't you take him some clothes, some, like, you know, change of clothes, and just show up there. So I did. I went and I took a change of clothes and said, hi, I'm here. And fortunately, he had a little bit of time. So we went around and we walked and talked and for many hours. And then I was just about to go back, and he said, just wait just a minute. So he went and he made a phone call. He came back and he said, the room that I'm staying in, actually, Irwin, the person who's supposed to stay with me, he's not coming back tonight because the true children are not ready to come yet. And he was going to drive them from East Garden. So my husband said, well, why didn't you stay? So you could imagine that was how our daughter was conceived, in the hotel at the science conference, our one and only daughter. So it was like a very amazing, I can't believe I'm telling this story. But it was like a very beautiful moment. As when I said goodbye to him, and I stopped at a coffee shop on the way back to go back, you know, to the Kamiyama's house, I was overwhelmed with this knowledge that I have a baby. It was like not even 24 hours, but I knew, and it was like this, and I started to cry while I was drinking coffee, you know, because I knew that was, anyway, and it was real, because I started getting sick when I smelled coffee a week later or two, and then, so funny, because that time was the very important times, it was right around Thanksgiving, so to tell you a long story short, again, I fundraised with my daughter in my womb for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Valentine's Day, Easter, and Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. Each time getting bigger and making good money because I was excited. I'm going to go to be with my husband when this is over. And So after Mother's Day, I went and joined my husband in Tarrytown, New York, and we had a room there, and I came back with a big stomach, and it was like very amazing experience. It's very strange to other people if they can't imagine something like that, but it was actually very beautiful for us. So our daughter was born, and we stayed in that room in the Kamiyama's house, and so that was the beginning of my life being on East Garden Belvedere staff, which I had a total of, I think it was 28 years I was there. So during that time, so many things we did. I was a preschool teacher. I was helped a lot of times when, you know, at East Garden you help a lot for different things. But the wonderful experiences that I had at the preschool were that I taught the grandchildren, the true grandchildren, quite a few of them, and very deep experiences, because they're treasures that you have yourself, you know. Nobody can take those away from you. But one particular memory, I guess you could say, I have is there were three cousins. It was Hyunjinim's son and, no, Hyunjinim's daughter, Hyungjinim's son, and Kukjinim's daughter. They were all the same age, within 1 or 2 months apart. So they were always in my English class and doing all the finger plays and laughing and joking and fighting and being just who they are. I just cannot take that memory away from me of the harmony they had. They were just like brother and sister. They were cousins, but they were just like brother and sister. And now they're like 16, I think. I think they're around 16, all three of them. We don't see them anymore, but they know that they had each other and had those experiences when they were young. They have those memories. So many times during the time when I was teaching there, the children did performances for the grandparents, Father and Mother Moon. And so we would be there taking care of them. And sometimes Father would speak. And so we had to wait a long, long time in the waterfall room with the children. And, of course, that's who we played with, and they knew us. And so I was known as Mary Sunsangnim when I was over in East Garden for many, many years. In fact, those kids, they still call me that. The Bornemans' children, they don't call me Aunt Mary. They call me Mary Sunsangnim, because that's how they knew me. And so that's the treasures that I had in those days, you know. They still know me, and we share those memories. What I should say is we share those memories, you know, the young grandchildren have gone through a lot, you know. They've gone through a lot. But I think that they have beautiful memories, too, that they still hold in their heart, you know. Wow, I sure skipped a whole lot of stuff in my... I don't even know what time it is. I have a little time still. My family. What was the part that I really didn't... I'll just tell you that as I was thinking about speaking today, one of the main things that came to me was how grateful I am for my husband. Because Mamoru, who actually was at East Garden for 38 years, he went when he was 20 and never moved to any other mission. And then when he was, you know... He came here, actually. Okay, so he. Let me tell you the story. our true parents were here in Las Vegas for a long time, right? For a few years. And during that time, many times, the security from East Garden would come for weeks at a time, and they would take care, and they had mission to to do security. And so my husband would come back and he'd say, well, Las Vegas is this way and that way. And I'd say, okay. And it sounded like it's something way far away and it's nothing to do with me, but I listened. Then father passed away in August of 2012, right? And then True Mother was asking my husband and myself to come here to take care of the property here. And my husband kept telling me that that's going to be, it's going to be, but I kept kind of not believing it because I didn't want to go. So I was in denial kind of. But the time did come, and True Mother asked us to come to meet, and we actually went there, and Mother asked my husband formally, can you go and take care of the Chonghogun property and take care of Kwanzanu's family and you? And she spoke to me in for a minute or two and said, wife of Mamoru, you can do Women's Federation. That's actually what she said at that time. But in the beginning when I came here, I wasn't sure if that's really what I need to be doing. But so, yeah, we came. We came here and then stayed for three years on this property in this room. And then last year, when True Mother moved everything to IPEC, where her residence in Las Vegas is now, we were asked to, you know, vacate the property and so open up every place for the church. And so God worked very quickly. I was, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get a house. And so I think sometimes God works in mysterious ways because you feel these feelings and then your blood is ready to go. So that's what happened. Whatever happened to us at that time, it was a positive thing in the end because I was ready to get a house. Wow. Within 4 or 5 days, we were signing for a house. And it happened so quickly. And within a couple of months, we were in our house in Henderson and got a good deal, a 4-bedroom house. And it was just a perfect, something that we could not even have imagined being in our situation, you know. So that's where we are living right now. We're living in Henderson, which is about 20 minutes from this property. So I'm not always used to being so far away because if I forget something, I can't go back, you know. But when we lived here, I could forget something. Oh, no problem. I'll go back and get it. So it was definitely a blessing living here, and we're still here. And my husband works at IPEC, and among other things. The one thing about my husband I really have to say is he never lost his spirit. Whatever spirit he had in the beginning while he was in East Garden all those years, he actually never changed missions. It's always the same. It's always doing what's the best for True Parents. And then the brothers and sisters are actually an extension of True Parents. And he's amazing. He takes care of people the way, I don't know, from what I can see anyway, basically the way he takes care of people is the way he is supposed to. Love them and take care of them and don't hurt them. Sometimes I'm going like, you should tell that person that no. And he'll give them three chances. Okay. So I've learned over the years, actually he's taught me a lot just by the way he is, to be patient and loving. And I mean, we're probably basically both that way, because I had a Christian background, and but I'm just really grateful that he's in my life. We have a 30-year-old daughter who's been blessed for 10 years, and they're doing well. They live in Manhattan. And the other day, when we went to the Famicon, this Famicon conference, we were asked, what is the thing that you're most grateful for? I think that was the question. I can't remember. And without a hesitation, it was my husband, because he's really taught me in so many ways. I probably wouldn't be here if it wasn't for him. He loves the True Children with a deep heart, and he's always been in the background, you know. He's never really desired to be a leader, if you want to call that. We're all leaders, actually. The thing is, we are all leaders. And then there's different types of leaders. There's external leaders, and there are leaders of... This is what I'm learning in Women's Federation, which we are... I'm now the chairwoman of Women's Federation for World Peace here in Las Vegas. And this is my vice chairwoman, Sarah Hirado. And this is what I'm really learning now. Somehow, I can't believe that it takes so long for us to learn some of these things, but leadership of the heart. Heart is is everything. It's easy to say it, but when you experience it, then you realize, oh, why didn't I do that way before, or whatever. But anyway, there was probably a lot of things I was going to talk about. Let's see. Okay, one more thing. When my daughter went to college in 2005, I decided, oh, okay, I'll go to college too and check it out. You know, so we were trying to get our preschool was trying to get
certified.
That's the word, and so they needed us to take some classes. So I started off with one, two classes. And then it wasn't long before I was taking full-time classes. And even my daughter, one time she was taking French class, and I was taking an early childhood class, and we had classes right next to each other. And at the break time, we both went out to the water to drink water. And she said, "Hi, Mom." And my classmates were, "Ooh, that's your daughter?" So we went to college together, and so from 2005 to 2010, I didn't have any college, and I graduated with a bachelor's degree, and then in 2011, I graduated with a master's degree in teaching English as a second language, and there was something else I was going to say about that. Anyway, that was... part of the reason I didn't want to come here to Las Vegas, because I wanted to do something with my degree, which I didn't so much do. Oh, okay. I did want to talk about a couple of things. Exercise. We were talking about exercise before. As we get older, we need so many to do so many things. We need to... we're not the same. I'm not the same as when I was 50. No. Or 55. Or 60. Or even 65. Every time you change, you different things in your body are changing, and you're becoming, so you have to take care of yourself as you get older. And so I often think of my sister. My sister passed away 4 years ago. She was the same age as I am right now. And she was in Southern California. One day I was sitting right here, and I got a phone call and said, my brother-in-law said, no, it wasn't my brother-in-law, it was my own brother, said, Judy is on life support, and she's the oldest of 10 children, of us 10 children. Oh, it looks like I left out a whole lot about my family. Anyway, there's 10 children in our family, And she was the oldest. She was always the one who hosted everything. She hosted all of our get-togethers, our reunions, and things like that. Well, she had a heart attack. And so my husband drove me to Southern California where she lived. And not even 24 hours later, she was gone. I was holding her hand, and she was gone. So it was very devastating to me. She was so young. And so every time, you know, I exercise, I do two different things. I do 4 years ago when I came here, one of the first things I wanted to do was found a yoga studio and yoga and Pilates. So there's about one mile from here, there's a place called Pilates and Yoga. And that's where I've been going for the last 4 years, as often as I can, not so often these days. And then the other thing that I've been doing, which was actually kind of interesting, is when I turned 65, I said to my hairdresser who was cutting my hair, I said, "What can I do to celebrate?" And she said, "You can join our bowling league." And I said, "Bowling? I don't even know how to bowl." She said, "No problem. My 92-year-old mother, she's the best bowler of all, and we're on a league. We have six teams. You can join one of the teams." So that's what I did. Within a week, I was on the bowling team. And that's been 2 years, and this is my third season. And my teammates are 84 and 1 year older than me. And the different teams, you know, like the 94-year-old lady, she's good. They go up to like 200 even sometimes, you know, 185 to... it's amazing. And let's see. Just a minute. I can't concentrate. Let's see. See, that's another thing that happens when you get older. You forget things really quickly. So there are six teams. And by the way, we are the top team. We are the top team of six teams.
All right.
Yeah. And I hadn't bowled for a couple of months because I was sick with this cough that has been lingering. And also, I was busy. And so they kept calling me, "Mary, when are you coming back to bowling? We miss you." So this week, 2 days ago, I went back to bowling. And, yeah, I could still do it. I have a good average. And so it's like typing or bicycle or anything else. Once you do it, you don't forget, you know. So that's what I'm doing. I want to be healthy, you know. I also have another brother that passed away at age 39. So, you know, we got to be strong. So I don't know. I guess I'm over. No, I didn't even go over. But I think that's it.